developing. It will be chilly too, with highs of 10 or 11 degrees. As we head into Wednesday, Wednesday starts off really cold across central and eastern parts of the UK with some patchy frost around, but it will be bright. The brightness will dissipate quite quickly through the morning as a spell of wet and windy weather spreads in off the Atlantic from west to east right across the country. As we head into Thursday, looks like it'll be a chilly, windy day with sunshine and showers. For Friday, ridge of high pressure builds, so lighter winds at times, plenty of sunshine, but that marks the area before Saturday. We'll see very wet and windy, windy weather spreading in from the west.
Many thanks, Staff. Staff Dinesh with the weather. Now, the new book of the week, An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth. The author is the Canadian Chris Hadfield, who returned from 5 months in charge of the International Space Station in May of this year. During his time in space, he became world famous for his Twitter and video posts from orbit, which offered breathtaking views of Earth and intriguing glimpses into life in space. In the first extract from his new book, he charts how he came to set out on this unlikely career. The reader is Garrick Hagen.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Lock your Soyuz hatch and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom.
The windows of a spaceship casually frame miracles. Every 92 minutes, another sunrise. A layer of cake that starts with orange, then a thick wedge of blue, then the richest, darkest icing decorated with stars. The secret patterns of our planet are revealed. Mountains bump up rudely from orderly plains. Forests are green gashes edged with snow. Continents splay themselves out whole, surrounded by islands sprinkled across the sea like delicate shards of shattered eggshells. Floating in the airlock before my first spacewalk, I knew I was on the verge of even rarer beauty. But poised on the edge of the sublime, I faced a somewhat ridiculous dilemma. How best to get out there? The hatch was small and circular, but with all my tools strapped to my chest and a huge pack of oxygen tanks and electronics strapped onto my back, I was square. Square astronaut, round hole. The cinematic moment I'd envisioned when I first became an astronaut, the one where the soundtrack swelled while I elegantly pushed off into the jet-black ink of infinite space, would not be happening. Instead, I'd have to wiggle out awkwardly and patiently, focus less on the magical than the mundane, try to avoid snagging my spacesuit or getting snarled in my tether and presenting myself to the universe trussed up like a roped calf. Square astronaut, round hole. It's the story of my life, really. Try to figure out how to get where I want to go when just getting out the door seems impossible. I started when I was 9 years old, and my family was spending the summer at our cottage on Stag Island in Ontario. We didn't have a television set, but our neighbors did. And very late, on the evening of July 20th, 1969, we jammed ourselves into their living room along with just about everybody else on the island. Slowly, methodically, a man descended the leg of a spaceship and carefully stepped onto the surface of the moon. The image was grainy, but I knew exactly what we were seeing. The impossible made possible. The room erupted in amazement. The adults shook hands. The kids yelped and whooped. Somehow, we felt as if we were up there with Neil Armstrong, changing the world. Later, walking back to our cottage, I looked up at the moon. It was no longer a distant, unknowable orb, but a place where people walked, talked, worked, and even slept. At that moment, I knew what I wanted to do with my life. I also knew, as did every kid in Canada, that it was impossible. Astronauts were American. NASA only accepted applications from U.S. citizens, and Canada didn't even have a space agency. But just the day before, it had been impossible to walk on the moon. Neil Armstrong hadn't let that stop him. Maybe someday it would be possible for me to go too. And if that day ever came, I wanted to be ready. I didn't announce to my parents or my brothers and sisters that I wanted to be an astronaut, but from that night forward, my dream provided direction to my life. I recognized even as a 9-year-old that I had a lot of choices, and my decisions mattered. What I did each day would determine the kind of person I'd become. I'd always enjoyed school, but when fall came, I threw myself into it with a new sense of purpose. Back then, much more than today, the route to NASA was via the military. So after high school, I decided to apply to military college. I majored in mechanical engineering, thinking that if I didn't make it as a military pilot, maybe I could be an engineer. I'd always liked figuring out how things work. And as I studied and worked numbers, my eyes would sometimes drift up to the picture of the space shuttle I'd hung over my desk. Since the odds of becoming an astronaut were non-existent, I knew it would be pretty silly to hang my sense of self-worth on it. My attitude was more, it's probably not going to happen, but I should do things that keep me moving in the right direction, just in case. And I should be sure those things interest me, so that whatever happens, I'm happy. The Christmas of 1981, 6 months before graduation, I did something that influenced the course of my life more than anything else I've done. I got married. Helena and I had been dating since high school, and she'd already graduated and was a rising star at the insurance agency where she worked. During our first 2 years of wedded bliss, we were apart for almost 18 months. I went to Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to begin basic jet training with the Canadian Forces. Helena gave birth to our first child, Kyle, and began raising him alone. Helena gave up her job, and she and Kyle moved to Moose Jaw to live in base housing, and then I was posted to Alberta to learn to fly fighters. It was, in other words, the kind of opening chapter that makes or breaks a marriage, and the stress didn't decrease when, in 1983, the Canadian government recruited and selected its first 6 astronauts. My dream finally seemed marginally more possible. A lot of people who meet us remark that it can't be easy being married to a highly driven, take-charge overachiever who views moving house as a sport. And I have to confess that being married to Helena has at times been difficult. She's intimidatingly capable, and exactly the kind of person you want riding shotgun when you're chasing a big goal and also trying to have a life. Eventually, I got a tiny taste of being a test pilot. When an airplane came out of maintenance, I would do the test flight. I was hooked. Fighter pilots live to fly, but while I love flying, I live to understand airplanes, why they do certain things, how to make them perform even better. Canada doesn't have its own test pilot school, but usually sends 2 pilots a year to study in France, the UK, or the US. In 1987, I was selected to go to the French school. We packed our things, we had goodbye parties. And then, 2 weeks before we were to wrangle our 3 young kids onto the plane, there was some sort of high-level dispute between the Canadian and French governments. France gave my slot away to a pilot from another country. We were beside ourselves. We'd hit a dead end. In retrospect, a heartbreaking disaster may be revealed as a lucky twist of fate, and so it was with losing the French slot in the spring. A few months later, I was selected to go to the U.S. Air Force Test Pilot School, TPS, at Edwards Air Force Base. And our year there changed everything. It was the first time, really, that I'd been part of a group of people who were so much like me. Most of us wanted to be astronauts, and we didn't need to keep our desire a secret anymore. TPS is a direct pipeline to NASA. It wasn't at all clear, though, if it would be a route to the CSA, the Canadian Space Agency. When, or even whether, the CSA would select more astronauts was anyone's guess. I was the top graduate that year at Test Pilot School, and also led the team whose research project got top honors. That was a big deal for me personally, and I took some nationalistic pride in it. This probably helped my case when the Canadian Air Force decided to send me on to the program at Pax River in Maryland, one of the few major test centers in the world. At first, I was pretty tentative. I'd spent my life trying to control airplanes, not send them ripping all over the place. But as I gained confidence, I started trying different techniques. By the end, I was hooked on the feeling of just how far out of control could I get the plane to go. In that program, we developed some good recovery techniques, counterintuitive ones that wound up saving planes as well as pilots' lives. Meanwhile, I worked evenings and weekends to complete a master's degree in aviation systems. As my tour drew to a close, my plan was to enjoy our final year in Maryland, spend more time with the kids, and play a little more guitar. And then the Canadian Space Agency took out an ad in the newspaper. Wanted. Astronauts. My application arrived at the CSA in January 1992, along with 5,328 others. After weeks of waiting, interspersed with more forms to fill and several interviews, I was amongst 20 candidates summoned to Ottawa at the end of April for a week. The other 19 applicants were impressive. Some had PhDs. Some were military college graduates like me. Some had reams of publications to their names. There were doctors and scientists and test pilots, and everyone was trying to project casual magnificence. There were in-depth medical exams involving many vials of bodily fluids and a great deal of poking and prodding. There was a mock press conference to see whether we were skilled at public relations or could be trained to do it. But the real make-or-break event was an hour-long panel interview. I thought about it all week. How to stand out yet not be a jerk? What were the best answers to the obvious questions? What should I not say? There was no actual feedback. I had no idea whether they liked me more or less than anyone else. I headed back to Maryland. We'd been told that on a particular Saturday in May, all 20 of us would get a phone call between 1 and 3 p.m. to confirm whether we'd been selected or rejected. When that Saturday finally arrived, I decided the best thing to do to make the time pass would be to go water skiing with friends who had a boat. Then Helena and I went back to the house to eat lunch and watch the clock. Shortly after 1 o'clock, the phone rang, and I picked it up in the kitchen. It was Mac Evans from the Canadian Space Agency asking if I wanted to be an astronaut. I did, of course. I always had. It was the heyday of the shuttle era, so ours was a big class by current standards, 24 of us in all. We took the elevator up to the astronaut office at Johnson Space Center, quietly giddy. This was one of the hardest offices to join in the world, yet we'd made it. We were the creme de la creme. Then we got off the elevator. Just like that, we were nobodies. We weren't even called astronauts, but ASCANs, astronaut candidates. In the course of my first day at JSC, I went from the peak of my profession to the bottom of the food chain. Just looking around the office and seeing people we'd idolized for years did the trick. When I was assigned to a desk beside John Young, one of the original Gemini astronauts, one of only a dozen men to walk on the moon, and the commander of the very first space shuttle flight, I didn't feel like I'd finally arrived. I felt like a gnat.
Garrick Hagen was reading the first extract from An Astronaut's Guide to Life on Earth by Chris Hadfield. It was abridged and produced by Jill Waters and is a Waters Company production for BBC Radio 4. In tomorrow's episode, Chris leaves Earth for the first time. The shipping forecast follows in a minute. In the meantime, we're sailing by. BBC Radio 4. Now, the shipping forecast issued by the Met Office on behalf of the Maritime and Coast Guard Agency at 0015 on Tuesday the 29th of October. There are warnings of gales in Fisher, German Bight, Humber, Thames, Dover, Wight, Portland, Plymouth, Shannon, Rockall, Malin, Hebrides, Bailey, Faroes and South East Iceland. The general synopsis at 1800. Developing ridge of high pressure expected Fitzroy to Bailey by 1800 Tuesday. The area forecasts for the next 24 hours. Viking, north at Sierra. Westerly, veering northerly, 4 or 5, occasionally 6. Showers, good. South at Sierra, mainly westerly, 4 or 5, occasionally 6 in south. Showers, good. Forties, Cromarty, 4th, Tyne, Dogger. West or northwest, 5 to 7. Squally showers, good. Fisher, German Bight, Humber.